President-elect Donald Trump is sentenced in his hush money case.
The protections afforded the office of the president are not a mitigating factor. They do not reduce the seriousness of the crime or justify its commission in any way.
The Earth passes a major milestone for climate change.
Indeed, the news is not encouraging, and the urgency of climate action has never been more important.
Join us now on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
After careful analysis, in obedience to governing mandates, and pursuant to the rule of law, this court has determined that the only lawful sentence that permits entry of a judgment of conviction without encroaching upon the highest office in the land is an unconditional discharge.
President-elect Donald Trump was sentenced Friday to no punishment at all in his hush money case, an outcome that cements his historic conviction while letting him return to the White House unencumbered by the threat of a jail term or a fine.
With Trump appearing by video from his Florida estate, the sentence quietly capped an extraordinary trial rife with moments unthinkable in the U.S. only a few years ago. Trump and his attorneys argued it was a politically motivated case that should never have been brought.
It's been a political witch hunt. It was done to damage my reputation so that I'd lose the election, and obviously that didn't work. And the people of our country got to see this firsthand because they watched the case in your courtroom. They got to see this firsthand, and then they voted, and I won and got the largest number of votes by far of any Republican candidate in history, and won, as you know, all seven swing states, won conclusively all seven swing states, and won the popular vote by millions and millions of votes. And they've been watching your trial, so they understood it.
It was the first criminal prosecution of a former U.S. president and major presidential candidate. Let's get more on this now from VOA's senior Washington correspondent, Carolyn Prasuti.
A surreal scene in a New York courtroom. The president-elect speaking virtually to the judge, claiming innocence, calling the case a political witch hunt intended to make him lose the November election. Minutes later, Judge Juan Merchan sentencing Donald Trump to an unconditional discharge, meaning the guilty verdict stands, but Trump receives no jail time, fine, or probation. The judge telling Trump he was not treated any differently than any other defendant. President-elect Donald Trump will now become the first president in U.S. history to take office as a convicted felon. He was found guilty last year of 34 counts of falsifying business records to hide hush money payments to a porn star. Trump has indicated he plans to appeal the verdict.
This was a disgrace.
Political analysts like Shannon Bo O'Brien of the University of Texas say this case was personal to Trump.
He doesn't like to admit fault. He doesn't like to admit weaknesses or shortcomings.
New York Supreme Court Judge Juan Merchan, who presided over the trial, had denied a delay, but also said he would not sentence the former president to jail. Gary Rose teaches politics at Sacred Heart University.
I think the message that really is conveyed here is that no one is above the law, and that the process has played out, and it's going to now bring, you know, it's going to bring it to an end.
In a second and third case, a Trump-appointed judge this week temporarily blocked the Justice Department from releasing final reports from special counsel Jack Smith. The cases, both dismissed, involved the storage of classified documents and election interference with the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. This week, the president-elect reiterated his belief that Smith was appointed illegally.
He was thrown off the case in disgrace. Why should he be allowed to write a fake report? It'll only be a fake report.
Special counsels are required to file summary reports. The U.S. Attorney General said he would release Smith's report on the January 6th uprising at the Capitol. Making that public could hamper Trump's efforts to pardon those arrested. Again, Professor O'Brien.
If a lot of this comes to light, that a lot of this was planned and a lot of this, these activities were malicious and they were criminal, he is giving people a free pass on criminal activity.
The fourth case deals with Georgia election interference. The prosecutor was removed due to an improper romantic relationship with an employee. So the case is at a standstill until it is dismissed or until another prosecutor is assigned. Again, Professor Rose.
I think the voters are actually hoping that this whole thing is brought to an end and that now we can begin anew with a second Trump term.
And that term starts on Monday, January 20th.
It feels great.
Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
And joining us now to explain all of this is Mark Sedlander, a trial attorney and litigator whose practice consists of white-collar defense and government investigations.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
So tell us what happened today. Just run us through the technical aspect.
Well, a defendant in a criminal case, in this case, President-elect Trump, was sentenced following a unanimous jury verdict in a criminal case in New York State Court. He was sentenced to what is called the very rare sentence, in fact, of an unconditional discharge, meaning his sentence is basically discharged without his having to do anything. Oftentimes, in certain circumstances, in somewhat unusual cases, a judge will impose, let's say, a probationary sentence or a sentence of the requirement to pay back some amount of money to the victims, after which time the sentence would be discharged. In this case, the judge discharged the case without President-elect Trump having to do anything. So that's why they call it an unconditional discharge. There are no conditions, and basically his sentence is over.
Why do you believe, since there was no real sentence, that the judge decided to go forward with this sentencing? And is this a first?
Well, I'll take those in reverse order. Certainly a first. We now have a convicted and sentenced felon about to assume the presidency. In terms of why the judge decided to proceed, many colleagues of mine and myself included would love to have been in chambers while the judge was probably deciding what to do in this unprecedented case. I would imagine that, and I'm just speculating here, that the desire was to have some sort of finality to the sentence rather than keeping it open and waiting until after President-elect Trump leaves office, perhaps 4 years from now, that the judge wanted to have some finality, finish the case, impose the sentence. But the main reason likely why, I mean, it's an unusual situation in that there are, in our country, certain restrictions that judges have to consider when it comes to imposing a sentence on someone who's going to be the president in a couple of weeks. So I think likely the sentence was imposed because the judge wanted some finality to the case, but the type of sentence was imposed, which was the unconditional discharge, which is about as lenient as it gets, especially for a felony, is because the defendant in this case is about to be the president of the United States.
Well, this was a low-level felony, right? It's not unusual for a first-time offender in a case like this not to get jail time.
I'm glad you brought that up. It is not unusual for, in white-collar cases, for a person who has not been convicted of a prior crime to get a sentence that does not include jail time. It is also common for people convicted of felonies in similar circumstances to get some relatively low amount of jail time, let's say in a number of months and less than a year. But that is usually for extraordinary, I don't want to say extraordinary circumstances, but relatively unusual circumstances. So let's say a person who is genuinely deeply remorseful, rehabilitated after committing the offense, first-time offender with an upbringing from an underserved community for whom this behavior was completely out of character, and who, for example, had already paid back the victims in full before sentencing, in addition to volunteer work for victims, similarly situated victims. If a person had come before a court with that type of background and asked for a sentence with no jail time, I could see how that would be a relatively normal sentence. In this case, President-elect Trump seems to be the opposite of that type of defendant. He has showing no remorse. In fact, my understanding is at the sentencing hearing today, he maintains his innocence despite the unanimous jury verdict convicting him on many felony counts. So it's extremely unusual for a defendant like President-elect Trump, who has behaved in a way that is very in the face of a conviction. The saving grace for him, of course, is his being elected to the presidency.
And will it impact his presidency in any way, or stifle his ability to perform all of the duties necessary in the role?
In a political sense, I'm not really the expert on that. It seems to have gone both ways. His convictions gone both ways in terms of helping or hurting him. In terms of practically speaking, this will likely have no effect on his ability to execute the duties of Commander-in-Chief and acting as President of the United States, because there are no conditions. This was the unconditional discharge. He's not being supervised by a probation officer, which is normal for what is called a conditional discharge. Generally, the default number of years for a felony conviction in New York State is 3 years of a conditional discharge, and that oftentimes will include the conditions of being supervised by some officer, or at a minimum, not committing additional crimes. So he has no restrictions. His sentence has already been discharged. So this likely will have no effect on his ability to execute the duties as he needs to.
And he can still, and is still, as I understand it, appealing the conviction itself.
Yes, perhaps. And that's entirely standard, and he has every right to do that. And oftentimes, when, in fact, usually when people are convicted after trial, they will exhaust appeals in the event that there were any issues in the trial court. That is a defendant's right, and it's standard. Especially in his case, he actually has an interesting issue. After the United States Supreme Court's immunity decision, there are interesting issues in his case that I think likely should be reviewed by appeals courts, and I'll be keeping a close eye on those as they proceed.
Like, give us an example.
Well, after the United States Supreme Court, in my opinion, shockingly came out with their immunity decision, essentially saying that a president of the United States is largely immune from prosecution for crimes committed in many circumstances while in office. One of the aspects of that immunity decision was to say that certain evidence, as it was an official act of the president while he or she is in office, cannot even be admitted as evidence in the trial court. Now, the New York State court for which President-elect Trump was just sentenced, that trial occurred before the United States Supreme Court immunity decision. So at the time, most Americans, and for most of our country's history, assumed that presidents were not immune from criminal prosecution or conviction in almost any sense. So a lot of evidence was admitted during that New York State trial that likely would not have been admitted after the United States Supreme Court immunity decision. So the question is, was that evidence admitted improperly because it shouldn't have been admitted now under the new immunity decision? And if it was admitted improperly, would that have changed the outcome of the trial in the New York State criminal case? And if so, the President-elect Trump has an argument about that.
Interesting. Thanks, as always, in everything involved with President-elect Trump, complicated and unclear.
It is. Well, I look forward to seeing how this plays out. But it seems like there's been, for the most part, an end to this case, and we'll see what comes up next.
Mark, right.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark Sedlander, a trial attorney and litigator whose practice consists of white-collar defense and government investigations. You're listening to The Issues in the News. I'm Lori London with Scott Walterman.
The Earth recorded its hottest year ever in 2024, with such a big jump that the planet temporarily passed a major climate threshold.
The many record-breaking events we have seen over the course of the last 12 months are not statistical oddities, but rather a direct consequence of the generalized warming of our climate system.
Carlo Buontempo, director of the EU weather agency Copernicus, on findings reported Friday by multiple global weather monitoring agencies.
The latest bleak assessment of the state of climate change comes as the death toll from wildfires raging in Los Angeles, the nation's second largest city, continue to burn, obliterating whole neighborhoods.
It's all gone. All gone. I mean, the kids were born here, raised them here, 20-some years. Built this and it's completely gone. Not just me, it's my whole neighborhood.
Here's NASA chief scientist and senior climate advisor Catherine Calvin.
Fires are very complex and there's multiple factors that contribute, and we're still learning about these fires. But in general, what we know is that climate change does increase the risk and severity of fires. For example, climate change can increase fuel for fires, the amount of dry vegetation that can catch on fire.
Joining us now for insights into these new climate reports and the implications is Erica Fleischman, director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University.
We've heard from multiple weather monitoring agencies that came out in the last 24 hours that the Earth recorded its hottest year ever in 2024, and that it was a very big jump, so much so that the planet temporarily passed the threshold or the long-term warning limit we've been hearing about of 1.5 degrees Celsius. What is your response to that?
It's part of a trend over time of increasing temperatures. 1.5 is not a fixed limit. It's not that anything in particular or irreversible happens at 1.5. That was set as a target for the general degree of global warming at which many effects on human and natural systems likely would exacerbate. But people should be thinking about those increases not as hard and fast limits or anything like that, but as the less increase in global temperature, the better.
What happens at 1.5 and as the Earth continues to warm? What are the kinds of things we should be looking for?
A lot of what we're seeing right now in major news outlets, a lot of the types of tragedies, unfortunately, we're seeing in the Los Angeles area. So extremes tend to be, warm extremes tend to become stronger. So we tend to see more extreme heat waves. We tend to see in most parts of the world an increasing frequency and duration and intensity of drought. There will still be cold spells. Cold spells are not becoming more intense. Actually, cold spells in general are becoming less intense and less frequent. But there will still continue to be cold spells and winter storms of various types. But most of the Earth is becoming drier. There are some areas that are becoming wetter. And even as some parts of the world are becoming drier, precipitation is tending to become flashier. So we're often seeing the same amount of precipitation in a particular location, but we're seeing it come in more intense events. And those events pose flood risks. It's not just temperature, but most of those changes in climate are a result of the world becoming warmer. We don't expect to see, in general, as many cold spells, and in general, we expect to see less snow rather than more snow. But that, again, doesn't mean that there aren't going to be winter storms.
And, you know, apparently if climate change pushing the planets to levels that, you know, it seems to be not moving backwards. It seems to, as you said, it's trending in this direction. Is it safe to say from the reports which said the planet's temperature levels are being pushed to levels that have never before been experienced by modern humans? And how likely is this to continue to get worse?
If humans continue emitting greenhouse gases through the range of activities that humans pursue, the planet will continue to become warmer.
And you mentioned the wildfires. Would you say that what is happening, these fires that are absolutely raging in Los Angeles, are one of many disasters that climate change is making more frequent and severe?
Climate change generally is associated with higher frequency of wildfires. It also, and that in part is because in the Western United States and in many other parts of the world, as the frequency and severity and duration of drought increases, you get more vegetation that's drying out. Or you tend to have extreme weather conditions coinciding with dry vegetation. You also tend to have higher temperatures and dry vegetation coinciding. And in these cases, the wildfires in LA are wind driven. So you get Santa Ana winds, which have always been a function of the climate in the region. But those, when they blow, are more likely to coincide with warm and dry conditions. The wildfire situation, it's also worth keeping in mind that the human population continues to grow, and that people increasingly are living in areas where housing is interspersed with natural vegetation. When the vegetation ignites and structures are able to ignite, then the structures basically become fuel and fires are moving from structure to structure. So this is not a case of, you know, what people sometimes think of as a forest fire that that is raging in a natural area and then pushes into a settled area. These are fires that are starting in settled areas and then moving from structure to structure.
I think it would be safe to say that no one who's been following the weather is surprised that we're at 1.5 above pre-industrial. But talk us through a continually warming planet. What happens at 2 degrees? What happens at 3 degrees above pre-industrial?
The human mind likes to fixate on particular points. There's nothing, it's a trend. So there's nothing in particular that happens at 1.5. There's nothing in particular that happens at 2 or at 3. But you can think of this as a trend, and we have these milestones where we say, oh my gosh, this trend is continuing. There's been an appreciable increase in global temperature. This is a big deal. I mean, what many of us think about is a lot more, unfortunately, human suffering, you know, people being displaced by natural events, be it drought or flood or wildfire or what have you. Obviously, really difficult for the people that are displaced. Many more people being exposed to smoke from the wildfires than from the wildfire flames. So you have the acute effects of the flames, but you also have long-term effects and more widespread effects of the smoke. And it's also really difficult, regardless of the hazard that's displacing people, for places that take those people in. I mean, we all hope that humans are kind to each other. And when someone is having a hard time, you try to help them out, give them a place to stay, give them food, services, what have you. But when you have tens of thousands of people displaced, most communities are not poised to immediately have the types of services necessary to feed people, to ensure they have livelihoods, to make sure kids can have education as uninterrupted as possible, what have you.
Right. And of course, there's the biodiversity issue with the climate changing so dramatically. That would ultimately impact humans as well, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And again, you know, keep in mind that it's not just climate changing, that the human population continues to grow and that there's widespread land use. So if you think about, you know, 20,000 years ago, the ability of wild animals and plants to move around, to find places that better suited their needs, that was much easier before there were very large areas of human settlement worldwide and widespread human activities.
There's no way to reverse it necessarily, from my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but is there a way to avoid things getting worse that's realistic at this point, given sort of the global inaction?
Well, if it becomes a priority of societies and governments worldwide to constrain emissions, it becomes feasible. And we've seen that societies can react to various phenomena fairly quickly, that things can change fairly quickly without major changes in societal values and government action. I would agree with you that it seems unlikely that emissions will decrease appreciably. But if it becomes a global priority and governments work together to reduce emissions levels, it's entirely possible. As you said, no, it won't be reversed, but the trends will flatten. And the maximum levels of warming and other types of climate change-driven disruption will be minimized.
Thank you very much for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for covering it.
Erica Fleischman, director of the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University.
And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our daily podcast, The Issue, available at voanews.com or wherever you get your podcast from.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then,
I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.